This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll explore the latest techniques in breast reconstruction. Plus, we'll learn all about that lethal cancer of the esophagus. But first, an update on a new drug to treat cystic fibrosis. Well, breakthroughs in medical science can drastically change the lives of patients. And 2 years ago on this radio show, we heard about one such breakthrough, a new treatment for cystic fibrosis. Well, here with an update and more on this is Dr. Ron Anbar, professor of pediatrics and medicine and the director of the Pediatric Pulmonary and Cystic Fibrosis Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Anbar.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by reminding us about CF. You know, what is this disease?
Cystic fibrosis is an inherited disease. Both parents have to carry the disease, but they don't have any symptoms. And one out of the four of their children can develop CF. When they develop CF, patients present with problems breathing and digestion. Although since 2002, we have had newborn screening in New York State, so babies are often diagnosed before they develop any symptoms.
Help us understand what CF does. I mean, what is it? How does it affect the person?
CF causes the mucus, the secretions in the body, to be very thick
and sticky.
And sticky. So the secretions, in a simple way, they plug up the lungs, they plug up the digestive tract, and so the lungs end up becoming injured because the secretions prevent infections from getting out of the lungs. And the digestive tract gets injured, and patients often need to take enzymes to help digest the food because the enzymes that the body makes gets plugged up.
Okay, so as you said, it's a recessive trait. In other words, both parents can have the gene, but it doesn't necessarily. But they don't have the symptoms necessarily. And what if they come together? One out of the four children might actually have it showing as a full-scale disease.
Correct. If you have one copy of the mutation, you do not have any symptoms. So parents are usually healthy. But it's a very common mutation. One out of 25 Caucasian Americans carries cystic fibrosis.
Really?
Yes.
That's actually stunning. Well, how many people today have the full-blown disease, would you say?
In this country, there's about 30,000 known patients. In central New York, we have 225 patients.
Okay. What are some of the consequences besides, obviously, having your lungs plugged up? I mean, is their lifespan shortened?
Unfortunately, lifespan is shortened dramatically, although we're doing much better in treating the disease. Currently, if a baby is born with cystic fibrosis, the statistics show that they will live to be an average of about 38 years. But this is greatly improved as compared to the 1950s, for example, when we had very little treatments and patients lived an average of a couple of years.
Really?
So because of new treatments, lifespans expanded. And actually, I'm very optimistic about cystic fibrosis. Because of advances such as the one we'll be discussing today, I think the lifespan may be near normal by the time we get finished.
Well, that's actually stunning. So how do you know if you have it?
Well, now in New York State, babies are diagnosed based on their genetics. If they were not diagnosed at a newborn period, the most likely way to diagnose it is you would have a lot of respiratory infections, and children often don't grow well because they don't digest their food well.
So there are those symptoms really kind of carry out. Since it's genetic, could this be avoided if parents were to have genetic testing in advance of a pregnancy?
Yes, genetic testing is available, and it is offered to parents who are thinking of having children and also to women who are pregnant. You can identify whether a fetus carries cystic fibrosis before they're born.
So I guess you were just alluding to this newest breakthrough, which I want to get to. It was about 2 years ago we had you on, and it had just been approved by the FDA. Tell us about what was approved and what this new treatment is doing.
So to understand this treatment, you need to understand that we are now aware that only over 150 different mutations of cystic fibrosis protein that cause disease. And this therapy, the breakthrough, only helps about a handful of these different mutations.
Well, let me stop you for a minute. Help us understand what happens to the gene. And there's a mutation in a particular gene in our bodies.
Correct.
And what does that do?
And this gene is supposed to make a protein that has a chloride channel. It's a protein that its job is to move salt, sodium and chloride in the body.
From cell to cell.
From cell to cell, actually from cell to outside of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And when this protein malfunctions, you have disease. The mucus becomes thick.
And there are a number of ways that that gene can mutate, is that what you're saying?
Correct, or that protein can mutate. So one way, for example, the protein never gets manufactured. Another way is the protein is manufactured, but it's defective. And it can be very defective or mildly defective. The breakthrough, the Kalydeco, the new medication, it helps patients who have a mildly defective protein. So this protein ends up in the cell surface. It actually gets manufactured in the cell surface, but doesn't work. And the new therapy makes the protein work.
So it literally repairs a damaged protein, so to speak? Or in some way...
It assists it so it can do its job.
It supports it. It supports it to do its job.
Right. But that only helps about 4% of our patients. The majority of the patients have a very severely defective protein that does never even make it to the cell surface, so the Kalydeco can't help it.
So let's back up. Tell us, when did this gene first get discovered?
Well, we discovered the cystic fibrosis gene after a number of years of hard work back in 1989. It was actually very interesting. We had no idea what the protein was. We had no idea what the defect was. And we studied families of patients with cystic fibrosis and just walked through their DNA and looked for an abnormality that affected all the families. And that's how they found the gene in 1989.
So mapping the human genome was a very important piece of this.
Very important piece.
It was fundamental to it.
Right. And when we first discovered it, we thought, the treatment will be just put in a new gene, just fix it.
And
we tried to develop designer viruses. What viruses do is they put in viral genes into the body. That's how viruses cause infections. We thought we'll put the cystic fibrosis gene into a virus, and the virus will infect the body, and then they'll be cured.
But sounds like a good idea.
Sounds a good idea, but the body fought off the viruses, even with the CF in it. So the body would not take the viruses. So that approach didn't work.
Interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Ron Anbar, and we're talking about a new treatment for cystic fibrosis. Well, so let's go back to that story. So attempts to introduce this new gene or mutation or help to the mutation didn't work.
Initial attempt did not work. There's still action in England. They're still trying to find a way of inserting the gene, but as most of the cystic fibrosis research no longer is trying to replace the gene, but trying to help find ways around the problem.
So now they did find this Kalydeco, which does support this protein in 4% of people.
Correct.
Excuse me. So what else? I mean, so what's happening with that drug?
Well, for the 4% of patients who receive it, it's done marvelous work. Their lung function has improved. Their weight has improved. They feel better. One of the patients told me, when I skip my Kalydeco, I know right away because I already feel that it doesn't work, that I'm not feeling as well. This particular patient stopped his other medications. He didn't think he needed them anymore. I'm not sure if that's the right thing yet, but maybe it is because this drug is pretty powerful and we're still learning how well it works.
So before this, we were basically treating this symptomatically.
Correct.
But currently, we're actually treating it by treating the underlying cause.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which makes it so much more exciting. But again, this affects 4% of the patients. What about the other patients? So we're developing, it's a new drug that's been developed, and it's actually representative of several new drugs of the same kind that's intended to help the patient with the severe mutation. And what these drugs do is they take the severely affected protein and help move it into the cell surface, and then they give Kalydeco, which helps that protein work.
So it's a two-drug approach.
It's a two-drug combination. But I don't think it's going to be a home run for those patients because I think we're going to end up having to have a three-drug combination. Turns out the mutation is so severely affected that one drug is not enough to move it to the cell surface. If you have two drugs, it would work even better. We believe with a three-drug combination, we might have a near a cure.
Are those drugs in the pipeline currently?
The second drug there's several versions of that drug in the pipeline. And we're actually doing research right here at Upstate with the second drug plus Kalydeco. The third drug I mentioned, that's still on the drawing board. We have to find it.
How do you determine what patients are going to benefit from it? In other words, do you do some kind of a genetic analysis of a particular patient and say, you have that type of mutation? I mean, how do you determine who gets treated and how?
Every patient at our center undergoes a genetic analysis. We know exactly what the mutation is. And actually, it's very interesting because we just had a baby born fairly recently who has the mutation called G551D. That's the mutation that Kalydeco helps. But this is a baby, and we're not giving Kalydeco to that patient yet because this medication has not been studied in babies, and we're not sure if there could be bad side effects.
That was my next question. When do you begin to treat someone?
Well, the studies of Kalydeco were done in children who are 6 and above, and adults. And the reason that age of 6 was picked is that that's when you can start looking at their lung function. Patients can perform pulmonary function testing, and we can see how well their lungs work. So in principle, it could work in infants. But again, we're worried about side effects because, you know, infants are not little adults. They react differently.
Right. They have unique chemistry, biochemistry. Correct. So we're basically, how many people in this country are getting Kalydeco? You said 4%. Is 4%. It happening throughout the country?
Correct. So basically, everyone who can benefit is on Kalydeco. And even though it's very expensive, nearly $300,000 a year per patient.
I was going to ask you that question because you said that the last time you were here, and I was hoping that perhaps the price had dropped.
The price has not dropped. It's like almost like $500 a pill. But again, the problem is if only 1,000 patients can receive it, there's a limited amount of money that can be made from this drug. And developing a drug can cost hundreds of millions of dollars.
So, hence the price.
So if you can't pay for it, you can't develop it.
So currently, are patients getting help with insurance? How do they manage this?
Insurance coverage has been available from virtually all patients. It's not been a problem.
Wow.
Fortunately.
So what do you expect to happen? Let's just take Kalydeco first. What do you expect to happen in terms of the longevity of these particular patients who are being helped and the quality of their lives?
Well, this is speculative. We know the quality of life has improved. They're feeling better. They're more active.
And on average, what are the ages that we're talking about of your patients who are on Kalydeco?
The ones in our center are all young adults. They're 20 and above, except for the baby who was just born, who was not on Kalydeco yet. It's speculative how well it'll work. I'm hopeful. I think as long as the patients didn't have a lot of lung damage before they got started on Kalydeco, I think the Kalydeco plus the other therapies can let them live into their 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Like you said,
I'm very
optimistic. A full lifespan.
A full lifespan.
So what's in the pipeline? Right now in terms of on the research bench, what's coming down the pike? And is there, you said in England they're still looking at trying to introduce
the gene
itself. Is there any hope of that, or is there any hope in utero of changing a situation? I mean, I know there's all this talk about trying to analyze someone's genetic makeup even in utero and then perhaps making introductory changes. Is that all science fiction, or is that possible?
Well, in utero, probably not in our lifetime. And one of the problems is if you give, for example, a drug that needs to get in through the bloodstream, you'd have to give it to the mother, too, and there's ethical problems. Would you give a mother a drug that could hurt her and to treat the infant? But we're far from being able to treat in utero. I guess the next likely thing that will happen is there's a couple of drugs, one called Vertex 809, one is Vertex 661, that help with the severe mutations, and those are the ones that are being studied actively right now.
Wonderful. Well, once again, I want to thank you. This is so uplifting to think that we're really making a difference in the lives of these patients and that there's some real hope ahead. My guest has been Dr. Ron Onbar, Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine and the Director of the Pediatric Pulmonary and Cystic Fibrosis Center at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, the latest techniques for breast reconstruction after mastectomy. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Many patients with breast cancer must undergo mastectomy or breast removal as part of their treatment, and it's been shown that breast reconstruction following this procedure can have very positive and beneficial effects on the patient's overall psychological state. We'll hear with more on this and the newest reconstructive options available is Dr. Prashant Upadhyay. He's an assistant professor of surgery specializing in plastic and reconstructive breast surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Thank you, Linda. Happy to be here.
So these reconstructive procedures have really come a long way in the last 30 years with better outcomes and more natural results. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, as you said, you're right. Reconstructive options have improved a lot, and the outcomes are getting better and better as we speak. A lot of this has to be attributed to the fact that insurance covers most of the reconstructive options. And in fact, there is a law which was passed in 1986 in which insurance is mandated to cover not only the breast surgery reconstruction of the breast cancer-affected breast, but also any matching procedures that might need to be done immediately or subsequently for the contralateral non-affected breast.
So it gives the patient a real option there to basically have the reconstruction without a lot of, you know, financial strain.
Exactly.
But yes. Tell us, I mean, there. It's my understanding that you can have reconstruction with either implants or you can use another part of the woman's body to do so, and that's called autologous kinds of transplants.
That's exactly right.
So, obviously, each of those have some advantages and disadvantages. I thought maybe we'd start out by saying, can you just give us a brief understanding of what the options are currently, in terms of timing, especially?
So, immediate reconstruction, in which the reconstruction is done as soon as the breast is removed in the same setting, is the gold standard now and is done in most of the patients who are reconstructed. And as Linda said, there are many, many options we have.
Why would you, when you say immediately done, you're saying that's the gold standard, so that's the desire, but there are times when it can't be done immediately.
Yes.
Explain that.
It could have to do with the disease. If the breast cancer is very aggressive and the oncologist thinks that the patient is better off not getting the reconstruction at that time, we could defer it.
And is that because of the types of therapy that would have to follow? In other words, if it's an aggressive tumor and there may be some additional cells elsewhere, they need to do different kinds of treatment?
Right. It all depends on what the patient's expectations are and their interaction with the oncologist. To be frank, there are not really a lot of indications in which you have to defer surgery. It used to be more common in the past, but now, as I said, we're getting better and better at it. We can actually continue our adjuvant therapy even with an expander or breast reconstruction in place. But there are some patients who do not want to undergo the trauma of reconstruction till they're completely cancer-free, which is understandable. But as I said, immediate breast reconstruction is becoming more and more common, and I would say 80 to 90% of the reconstructions done now are immediate.
So you have the immediate one, which, as you said, most common, and then you have what they call delayed, so that's following chemotherapy or radiation treatment. And then there's something that I saw called immediate delayed. And what exactly is that? What are you doing at that time?
It used to be in the past that in case we did not know the actual disease status, because it takes a couple of days for us to get the results back from pathology, we would put in a spacer to buy time. And in case the disease came back as not very extensive, we would go ahead and do the reconstruction.
So what did the spacer do? How did it buy time for you?
It just prevents the skin of the breast from retracting. But as I said, it was done in the past. It's not a very common modality right now.
So basically you're saying most often and with today's techniques, you can have a reconstruction immediately.
I would say so.
And insurance does take care of it.
Insurance does take care of it.
So can you explain then the different options? You have breast implants that are often made of, I know, saline or silicone.
Yes.
And then you have this idea of the autologous.
Yes. So broadly speaking, you can classify breast reconstruction into implant-based and autologous. Implant-based can be single stage, in which the patient undergoes the mastectomy, undergoes a single stage direct to implant breast reconstruction, as in she wakes up with her breasts back. that can be applicable to a select few patients, patients who are relatively thin and do not want to be much larger breasted than they are already are. One more thing we are doing more and more commonly now is nipple sparing mastectomy, in which the patient's nipples are left as it is and the incision is made away from the nipple. And it's actually very well hidden below the breast. And we sometimes, if the patient's anatomy is conducive, we can actually insert an implant, a silicone gel implant. And this is known as immediate direct-to-implant breast reconstruction. Patient wakes up with breast completely intact.
Does it look as natural as it would have been before?
It very closely mimics after some time, maybe in a couple of weeks. Initially, you will have the postoperative changes. And if I may be audacious, I may say sometimes they end up looking better because it's essentially filling the breast, empty breast pocket with a saline or silicone gel implant, which probably is a better profile.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with plastic surgeon Dr. Prashant Upadhyay, and we are talking about breast reconstruction after mastectomy. So that's the immediate using the implants. There's also this whole world of autologous, as
right.
And autologous means using parts of the person's body.
Right.
Explain that.
Yeah, so a select few patients do not want any kind of foreign bodies in them. So they qualify for autologous breast reconstruction. There are also some people who have had radiation and their body tissue, the chest tissue, is not good enough to construct a breast. The indications for autologous breast reconstruction are very, very strict, and I would say 10 to 20% of the patients actually qualify for that. This is a much bigger surgery, and it can be done, broadly speaking, in two ways. You can either get the tissue from the abdomen or from the back. There are various indications, and it all depends on the patient preferences and the patient habitus and anatomy.
So there are different techniques along the I've seen different acronyms. There's an LAT flap, a DIEP flap, an SIEA flap. Can you
Yes.
explain kind of what you're doing there?
Yes. The LAT flap, it used to be very common in the past, and I think the indications for them have started going down. That's essentially us swinging a muscle from the back, the latissimus dorsi, into the front.
So the latissimus dorsi muscle is swung from the back into the front.
Into the front, along with some skin of the back, if needed. The advantage is that it's not as extensive a surgery as getting soft tissue from the belly, but it gives you soft tissue, which is sorely needed. Again, the indications for this have started going down just because the implant-based surgery has become better and better. The other more common autologous reconstruction method is getting tissue from the abdomen, which can be done in a variety of ways. One is to just swing the whole muscle and tissue up, which is a pedicle flap, which used to be very common in the past and now is a backup autologous reconstruction. The more common is getting soft tissue along with its blood supply and re-transplanting it to the chest.
And would you say, in your opinion, which of those, whether it be autologous, whichever of the techniques you use autologously, or implants, which are the better outcome or the more natural outcome?
That's a very good question. There have been various studies, and the outcomes actually is all based on patient preference. You have to understand that the autologous reconstruction involves a lot of surgery, and immediately, patient probably will not be happy with it, but in 5 years, probably will have a better natural-looking outcome without any foreign bodies in them.
Getting back to the foreign body idea,
yeah.
It was very much in the press in the last 10 years or more, a lot of controversy around silicone implants. What's the current status these days?
Well, as everything, things are blown up out of proportion. The good news is, in America at least, it's under a strict regulatory authority, and silicone implants have been reintroduced only for the last 7 years or so. But during this time, during the past 20 years or so, when silicone implants were not allowed here, they have been used in the whole world without any undue side effects. Now, there are very, very rare side effects, but the implants are getting better and better now. They do not leak out like silicone oil, like used to happen. And that's probably what most of the listeners are used to seeing on the internet.
Yeah, and all the news saying that people
right.
are having all kinds of untoward effects
yes.
as a result of that leakage.
Yeah.
How about the saline? Is one superior to the other?
Well, I mean, I guess it's my personal preference, but saline implants do not have the natural feel or the look of silicone gel implants. Now, again, I offer both to patients, it's the technique remains the same, but I think the longevity of the results are better and the feel of the breast is better with silicone implants.
So overall, what do you see as the advantages or disadvantages of all of these techniques? In other words, this idea of immediate versus delayed or implant versus autologous, you've had a lot of experience with this.
So a lot of patients now actually wake up with their breasts intact. So even if I put expanders or spacers, as is known, we expand them pretty aggressively. And when the patient wakes up, they don't wake up with a flat chest anymore, like used to happen before. Now, for females, it's very, very debilitating to wake up with a flat chest, even if they did not have very big breasts to begin with, because they feel a loss of femininity. So our goal is to avoid that so that when they wake up, they actually wake up with breast mounts. And for sometimes, they actually look better than what they were before they went under the knife.
So from your experience, though, you don't see, obviously it's much more surgically involved to have these autologous procedures, but you feel that it's pretty equivalent, it's pretty much a personal choice in terms of whether you get the implant or whether you go for the autologous?
Well, I offer all the modalities of treatment to the patient, and then I let the patient pick up what they want. But majority of the patients will be served by implant-based reconstruction.
What are the risks of either of these?
Well, the biggest risk with implant-based reconstruction is infection. So at any given time, a foreign body, if it gets infected, has to come out. So that kind of is a big deal.
What's the incidence of that happening?
I would say anywhere from 5 to 10% of the implants can get infected.
Hmm.
Again, we're getting better and better at it. We're kind of figuring out what causes these infections and trying to avoid it.
And if someone were to have an infection, that would mean removal of the implant, and then is it possible to then have another re-implant?
Yes, we just have to wait for a couple of months, wait for the infection, everything to cool down, and then we can either try the implant-based reconstruction again or try the autologous reconstruction method. The point is you always have an option.
And today it sounds like the options are getting better and better.
Yes.
And in terms of techniques, especially.
Techniques. And I would also like to mention fat grafting, which I think is a very powerful weapon we have in our
Explain
system.
That. Yeah, what is that?
So basically, after breast reconstruction, if we have certain lumps or dimples, we can always fill them up with actually taking fat and processing it from somewhere else and then filling it up, filling all those defects up.
So that's another way of making things look most natural.
Yes.
And very positive.
Yes.
Okay. I also read very briefly that some women who have the autologous may need physical therapy. So there's a lot to be considered
if
they've had muscle removed from some other places
right.
and all
that. So the recovery period is more extensive after autologous reconstruction,
So much information, but obviously timing, treatment, and so many other things go into it. Everybody's got to decide for themselves, but there's a lot of hope out there.
Yes.
My guest has been Dr. Prashant Upadhyay, and he is Assistant Professor of Surgery specializing in plastic and reconstructive breast surgery at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, Healthy Eats.
Hi, this is registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator Julie Mellon with Healthy Eats. In this week's segment, I would like to talk about food safety for moms-to-be. Eating healthy during pregnancy is one of the best things you can do for yourself and your baby. But not all foods are safe. Foodborne illness is a serious issue. The good thing is you can do a lot to prevent foodborne illness. When you're pregnant, your ability to fight off infection is lower, and this can make you more susceptible to getting sick from certain things, including food. Harmful food, microorganisms, and some metals in food can cross the placenta and actually infect the developing fetus. There are three specific foodborne risks to be aware of. These risks can cause serious illness or even death to you or your unborn child. They are listeria, methylmercury, and toxoplasma. The first one, listeria, this is a harmful bacteria that actually grows at refrigerated temperatures, and it causes an illness called listeriosis. pregnant women are about 20 times more likely to get listeriosis than other healthy adults, and about one-third of all the cases occur in pregnant women. It is found in refrigerated, ready-to-eat foods and unpasteurized milk, milk products, and unpasteurized ciders. So when you're pregnant, you don't want to eat things that where that bacteria will grow. Hot dogs and luncheon meats, unless they're reheated until they're steaming hot. Soft cheeses that are not pasteurized. Some of those include feta, brie, camembert, blue vein cheeses, queso blanco, queso fresno, and panela. If they're pasteurized, they're okay. Refrigerated pâtés and meat spreads, refrigerated smoked seafoods, unless they're in a cooked dish, raw milk or food that contains raw, unpasteurized milk, unpasteurized juices and ciders, and it's important to keep your refrigerator clean and cool, 40 degrees or below. The second, methylmercury, is a metal that is found in certain fish. At high levels, it can be harmful to your baby or young child's developing nervous system. It's found in higher amounts in large, long-lived fish, such as shark, swordfish, tilefish, and king mackerel. We tried to recommend not eating those at all. It is okay to eat up to 12 ounces a week of a variety of fish and shellfish that are lower in mercury, such as shrimp, canned light tuna, salmon, pollock, and catfish. Third, toxoplasma. This is a harmful parasite that causes an illness called toxoplasmosis. It is found in raw, undercooked meat, unwashed fruits and vegetables, contaminated water and soil, and dirty cat litter boxes, and outdoor places where cat feces can be found. If possible, when you're pregnant, have someone else change that kitty litter box. Wear gloves when gardening. Don't get a new cat when pregnant. Cook meat thoroughly and wash all fruits and vegetables before you eat them and before you cut into them. In addition, there are some simple things you can do to help prevent foodborne illness. They are clean, separate, cook, and chill. Clean means wash your hands and surfaces often. Wash all fruits and vegetables before eating. Separate means don't cross-contaminate. Keep raw food away from the ready-to-eat prepared foods. Cook foods to proper temperatures, especially your meats, eggs, poultry, seafood, leftovers, and use a food thermometer to check that temperature. Chill. Refrigerate foods promptly at 40 degrees or below. Don't leave foods out for more than 2 hours. Toss foods that have been past their expiration or use-by date. Pregnancy is such an exciting time. Good food safety practices will benefit you and your family for a lifetime. Be safe and enjoy this special time. This has been registered dietitian Julie Mellon, serving you healthy eats.
Coming up next, all about that most lethal cancer, cancer of the esophagus. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I am Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for May 19th. Nearly 1 in 5 people living with HIV don't know they have it. Many other STDs, such as chlamydia, herpes, and gonorrhea, also go untreated. Doctors don't test for STDs as part of a routine checkup, so be sure to speak up, especially if you've had unprotected sex or sex with multiple partners. Getting tested today could save your tomorrows. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, the past 25 years have seen the rates of some cancers fall, thanks to better prevention efforts. But during the same period, the frequency of some esophageal cancers have risen dramatically. The cause of this increase remains a mystery, although some important risk factors have been identified. Well, here with more on this are Dr. Vanessa Gibson and Dr. Barbara Robinson. They're both assistant professors of surgery, specializing in thoracic surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start by explaining, what do we mean by esophageal cancer? I mean, what exactly is it?
It's basically a cancer involving the esophagus, which is the food tube that propels food into the stomach from the mouth. There are two main types of this cancer, both a squamous and an adenocarcinoma.
What does that mean when you say the two types? They're different cells types that cause a tumor growth?
Yes, both the cell type and the cause is different, as well as the prognosis.
Is there some... are the causes different for the different types? In other words, would a cause of squamous cell be different than the adenocarcinoma, for example?
Definitely. Adenocarcinoma is basically, in this country, arises out of a change in the lower part of the esophagus due to largely reflux into the esophagus from the stomach, whereas squamous cell carcinoma is found more outside this country, and it usually involves a possible viral infection of the esophagus itself.
Is there some issue? Well, let's go back and talk about the different risk factors. Do we know what the causes or risk factors are for these kinds of cancers?
Certainly. Well, just like for coronary artery disease and for smoking and for lung cancer, smoking and alcohol are high risk factors for people with squamous cell. And this is really a pandemic, actually, around the whole country, not just the 18,000 cases that are in this country, of which about 16,000 die. But the risk factors are different for adenocarcinoma. So like Dr. Gibson mentioned, reflux. But also another significant risk factor is obesity.
And there's some suggestion that the obesity might be why we're seeing a rise in that.
Definitely. I've seen a pattern of change in just over the last 10 years in the patients that I see undergoing surgery for esophagectomy.
So at one point you were saying, before we actually sat down to talk, that at one point people with esophageal cancer looked very different to you as a surgeon. What was the difference?
Yeah, 10, 15 years ago, the typical esophageal cancer patient would be more cachectic with a massive weight loss due to inability to swallow. Now we're seeing more patients that do not have a significant weight loss and, in fact, are morbidly obese. They do also experience the same symptom of dysphagia, which
is inability to swallow.
Correct.
I want to talk more about that in a minute, but let me just get this linkage clearer. The idea here is that if you're obese, you develop problems with reflux, which is basically food acids going back up into your esophagus, irritating the esophagus and leading to something sometimes called a Barrett's esophagus.
Barrett's esophagus basically refers to the changes in the cell type that we see at the bottom of the esophagus.
And that can go on to become a malignancy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where the link between obesity and possibly what they're hypothesizing is the reason for increase, because with the increase in the numbers of people in this country who are obese, there's the potential for that to happen.
Yes.
And it sounds, and you were quoting just a minute ago, Dr. Gibson, that you were... that the incidence has gone up so that now we are at about over 18,000 people are diagnosed over 15,000 die.
Yeah, so it's the incidence of the adeno that's going up primarily in this country.
Tell me about what some of the... Are there other risk factors? You mentioned tobacco use. You mentioned alcohol use, obviously.
Those are certainly more prevalent and more risk factors for the squamous cell type, but some perhaps infectious... etiologies maybe. There's a theory, there's mixed literature on the recently diagnosed infection Helicobacter pylori, but that may actually be protective, and it's not actually entirely sure why.
How about age? Is age a factor? Do you have to be over a certain age, for example? I mean, you don't see it.
I mean, certainly disease increases, you know, with age. However, I have a gentleman over at another hospital who's only 32, you know, so not necessarily.
And how about whether it's male or female? Is it gender related?
Males have about a 3 times higher risk of developing cancer as opposed to women. We also see esophageal cancer patients who have other motility problems of the esophagus, meaning they may have another disease process that could lend them to becoming more susceptible to developing a cancer later.
So what are the symptoms? What are the signs? I mean, how do you know? You've been mentioning that mm-hmm. trouble swallowing, dysphagia, mm-hmm. is one.
Chest pain is another one.
Which could be confused with other things.
Correct. A lot of these patients will present with chest pain and be worked up as a cardiac patient. And once that workup has become negative for a cardiac source of their chest pain, the esophagus should be the very next thing that's investigated.
How about this issue of weight loss? Is that also a hallmark?
Absolutely. By the time people come to you, they can have anywhere from 10 to 50 pounds of weight loss. But however, like Dr. Gibson mentioned recently in the past week, we had a patient who actually was obese. But just because a patient is obese doesn't necessarily mean that their nutritional status is good. So for that reason, we always check three nutrition labs to, assess that as well. Because many people, even before an operation, might need a tube, to improve their nutritional status so that they can withstand surgery well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm here with thoracic surgeons, Doctors Virginia Gibson and Barbara Robinson, and we're talking about esophageal cancer. So how is it diagnosed? How do we actually make the diagnosis?
There are a number of tests that a patient may undergo before being referred to us. Generally, they have obtained something called an esophagram, which is an x-ray basically where they swallow a contrast that will show a potential obstruction in the esophagus. Many of them have undergone something called an endoscopy or an EGD, which is placing a lighted scope that allows direct visualization of the esophagus. Some of them have had CT scans or MRIs and PET scanning once the diagnosis has been established.
So those are crucial. I mean, that kind of imaging in most cases is essential to making the diagnosis.
Both for identifying the cause as well as potentially staging the disease as well.
And another absolutely critical test that's mostly been used in the last 10 years is the EUS. And the reason why that's important is because if you have invasion, say, between the middle of the wall or lymph nodes, you may not be a good candidate for surgery right off the bat, but you might need some surgery, some chemotherapy or radiation before surgery. And the CT scan is not very specific for being able to tell the depth of invasion, but it certainly is critical to pick up, spread, say, to the lung or brain or liver beforehand.
I have several questions.
So obtaining an EUS is mandatory.
What does EUS stand for?
So endoscopic ultrasound. So it checks for lymph nodes along the length of the esophagus, as well as what layer of the five walls of the esophagus the tumor has gone through.
Why is the disease so lethal? I mean, is it have something to do with the anatomy or physiology of the esophagus? Does it have to do with the cell types? What makes it so lethal?
A lot of it is by the time somebody comes to you, they've been symptomatic for quite a while, and so they oftentimes have spread, and
so
they've lost
a late diagnosis is part of it.
But if it's somebody who's being followed with Barrett's, they might come to you earlier, and there's certainly two major, differing schools of thought of how to treat that across the country.
Are they doing much preventative stuff when someone's being diagnosed with reflux or Barrett's? Do you find that prevention does do what it's supposed to do, which prevent the disease or prevent the development of esophageal cancer?
Patients that have established Barrett's changes of the esophagus are followed with surveillance endoscopy, usually on an every 1 to 3 year basis, depending on the advancement of the Barrett's itself, and undergo frequent biopsies to establish whether they have developed changes that would be leading to more to an adenocarcinoma.
Are there other preventive methods that people should know about? I mean, obviously, if you don't want to be excessive in smoking or alcohol, but are there other things that people should know about in terms of prevention?
Yeah, I think definitely making sure that if you have Barrett's that you go for your annual follow-up, and the recommendations definitely change from year to year. But as we know, there's been a lot of papers and expertise from the Mayo Clinic, that shows there's a 40% risk of cancer with Barrett's, and even if you just shave off the inside of it, you can still have areas of cancer that are kind of deeper to the areas that you shave that you may not know about, actually.
Yeah, and while there's no direct correlation between, certain food diets that are higher in fruits and vegetables obviously pretend to a lower risk of cancer, and not just for esophageal, but for other cancers such as pancreatic, colorectal, things like that. And there's also been a correlation between people that eat really hot foods or drink hot liquids.
Hot, spicy foods.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That can destroy the lining of the esophagus. So
there's something to that. I mean, sometimes you think of that as a so-called old wives' tale, but
it is true.
And nitrosamines and red meats, too, so...
How about let's get to treatment now. So, I mean, obviously you've alluded to several types of treatment, surgery being one that you're both very intimately involved with, but give me an overview of the kinds of treatment options.
Treatment is based on staging, which would be performed by a multitude of modalities, as we've discussed before, with the imaging studies and with the ultrasound endoscopy.
And we would determine how serious, how aggressive, to what degree, to what layer within the esophagus the disease has spread.
Yes, direct invasion from the tumor itself, as well as spread into lymph nodes or other organs. Generally, stages 1 and 2 are treated with surgery or a combination of chemotherapy and radiation treatment. Higher stages are generally treated with a trimodality approach, utilizing neoadjuvant, which means before surgery, using chemotherapy and radiation.
And that's to shrink the tumor potentially or somehow diminish it before you actually go in and surgically excise it?
Correct.
Is that
exactly,
the idea?
Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, there are some other techniques I've read about as well. If some people are too ill to have major surgery or it's spread to other organs, I mean, what
goes
on then?
There are some palliative-type procedures that we can do endoscopically to aid the patient in being able to swallow with pain or with potential perforation of the esophagus.
Things like a feeding tube as well, if necessary.
Mm-hmm. If necessary.
Yep. Or even stenting. We had a gentleman last week that we placed a stent so they can be able to swallow. And although the tumor is invading into an adjacent organ, you can at least swallow and be able to go home.
I don't want to run out of time. There was one other treatment that I came across, photodynamic therapy. What exactly is that? Some kind of a special drug, is that injected into the tumor and then exposed to light? That was something that I thought was quite different.
Yep. If you have, say, for instance, a local recurrence that you cannot eliminate, oftentimes people come back for weekly photodynamic therapy. They have to be very careful to not be in the light, for extended times of period. And it's also generally a palliative type of treatment.
Is, again, just maintaining the person comfortably. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot to think about. It's obviously quite a serious disease and something that, if we can be prevented, should be. But I'm so glad you're both here and helping those patients. And a lot of very good information. My guests have been Dr. Vanessa Gibson and Dr. Barbara Robinson. They're assistant professors of surgery specializing in thoracic surgery at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poets are well known for their ability to draw a portrait or a scene succinctly, not one word or one syllable wasted. Physicians, too, learn such compression, how to assess and diagnose quickly and expertly. When the poet is also a physician, we can hear the two worlds come together in a rush of imagery, as we do in the next poem I'd like to read. It's by Gaetan Scarrow, a physician from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His poem, Circus Man, brings vividly to life a person who was a performer who was right at his life's end. Here is Circus Man. His name was Daniel, and he had no one but knife-throwing eyes, pachyderm skin, and tobacco tar hands to speak for him. His legs were thin as wires, having outrun lions, pinned in the end by tumors, trampling his heaving chest, his airway closing like a fist. He could not raise his voice, had never learned to write, could only nod, "I understand if you take the tube out," or "No, I have no family," or "No, I do not want a priest," and "Yes, goddamn, I understand, I understand, I understand." We took it out, and he never revealed how a man swallows flame, how to sleep among cats, how to fall from a train. He just shuttered his eyes, leaving only his name, which was Daniel.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore stories of spiritual care from Upstate University Hospital, plus what the new verification of a Level 1 trauma center for Upstate University Hospital and Golisano Children's Hospital will mean for the Upstate community, and what screening tests do women need throughout their lives to promote good health. If you'd like to listen to again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it just by going to our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.